Iranian experts and ophthalmologists have gathered in Tehran to unveil a new method in eye surgery which enables the doctors to cure problems in their offices without anesthesia and bleeding. Paniz Plexer offers an alternative to invasive surgical procedures, reducing recovery time and any complications that can arise before and after surgery. It is an innovative development in eye treatments by utilizing the fourth state of matter, or plasma.
This new technique that uses plasma is being practiced for the first time. Within the past 20 years, plasma has been used in dentistry, treatment of cancer, and scar healing. Since some years ago, we decided to use it in ophthalmology to make sure it is safe. Almost 15 eye diseases can be cured at the doctor's office without going to the surgery room.
This is an international event to unveil a low-cost method for eye disorder treatments. It is a pain-free Iranian method called PANIS, or plasma-assisted non-invasive surgery. This is a result of 5 years of collaboration between two Iranian companies and an Italian counterpart.
This method has been practiced in many countries, but Iranian scientists have now turned it to a method to decrease treatment costs, as it does not need surgery rooms and hospital beds.
Such outstanding achievements show that the sanctions by the West have not been able to slow down Iran's advancement, proving that the Islamic Republic is moving forward on the right track. Humam Abedi, Tehran.
For refugees in reception camps in Greece, it has been a year of fires, double displacement, and now COVID-19. With rolling lockdowns enforced since March, along with restrictions that have only served to make unbearable living conditions even worse. In response to this, independent groups have sprung up and are trying to make a difference. Yellow Days is one of them, empowering forced migrants and changing the narrative surrounding their circumstances lies at the heart of everything they do. The friendships forged during Yellow Days festivals have lasted, and although COVID-19 prevented them from getting together in 2020, the team is still busy making magic happen online.
We have this, you know, distortionate idea of feeling that the refugee community has poor people, they're waiting to be helped, they're just depressed and waiting for answers, and it's far from the reality that I have experienced, especially with all my forced migrant friends. They're people that are active, they're people with loads of skill, power and talent, and all that we do at the Yellow Days is bring all those people together.
Yellow Days is run by a core group of 8 women, which members say is one of its most important aspects. One of the primary goals of groups like this is creating a model for a more sustainable future, not only for forced migrants and minorities, but the entire human race.
Because our system of capitalism and white supremacy, what we definitely know is that we can't rely on governments to help, and the media propaganda machine is so well financed and consistent that we are lacking not just political will but also human will. And I think this isn't really a time this year with COVID and 2020, this has also been a time for people to start waking up to their own power.
The International Rescue Committee says depression, post-traumatic stress disorder and self-harm that are the byproducts of hopelessness and despair have spiked amid COVID-19 restrictions. With the majority of asylum applications on pause, there's no means of escape, and during COVID-19, self-isolating often means being locked in a shipping container with many others.
More than half of those surveyed said that COVID has caused them depression, worry, anxiety and loneliness.
Every year, tens of thousands of refugees reach Greek shores. The media has aided the dehumanization of asylum seekers by reducing them to just that, a statistic. But there are still those fighting for stories to be told and lives celebrated. Bianca Rahimi, London. Thank you.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Despite a purported satisfactory performance last week, shares in the London Stock Exchange still have some way to go before they reach their pre-crisis level. Here, the asset class that has defied the depressed state of the economy and the health emergency is residential property. Stay with us for an article written by Larry Elliott. The piece is titled, Are Soaring Markets and House Prices an Epic Bubble About to Pop? The article has been taken from the British newspaper The Guardian. Stay with us for more of Larry Elliott's article. There was plenty of bad news in America last week. A mob of US President Donald Trump's supporters stormed the Capitol building. The number of new COVID-19 infections hit a record high and employment fell by 140,000. None of it fazed Wall Street, though, which continued to climb to dizzying new heights. That's the way with financial markets. When they're in the sort of mood, they go up when the news is good. And they go up when the news is bad. Last week's disappointing jobs report was a case in point. The fact that businesses had been shedding labor meant Joe Biden would have even more of an incentive to deliver an expansionary tax and spending package soon after he becomes president on 20th of January. The loss of jobs in the eyes of Wall Street was not a bad thing at all. Rather, it was a reason to continue buying into a stock market that is higher than it was before the coronavirus pandemic began. Despite a purported satisfactory performance last week, shares in the London Stock Exchange still have some way to go before they reach their pre-crisis level. Here, the asset class that has defied the depressed state of the economy and the health emergency is residential property. According to the latest data, from the Halifax Building Society, the cost of the average house rose by 6% in 2020, an annual rate of increase normally associated with a growing economy, not one that has just seen its biggest decline since the Great Frost of 1709. There are some specific reasons why house prices are going up in the United Kingdom. UK Chancellor of the Exchequer Rishi Sunak's temporary stamp duty holiday is one. The desire for houses with a bit more space and a garden is another. The fact that many people can afford to buy a more expensive home because they have saved money whilst working from home is a third reason. But what links rising share prices in the United States and rising house prices in the United Kingdom is money creation by central banks. Both the US Federal Reserve in Washington and the Bank of England in London have ramped up their quantitative easing programs, under which the central banks buy financial assets, usually government bonds, in exchange for cash. In theory, the newly created money could fund new productive investment for companies eager to expand. But in reality, much of it has been lent for speculative activity of one sort or another. There is no real mystery about this. It happened after the financial crisis of 2008, and it is happening now. The major central banks say they had no choice because the alternative would have been a financial meltdown that would have made last year's economic collapse even worse than it was. Their critics say quantitative easing, as currently designed, widens the gap between the rich and the poor, fails to put money into the bits of the economy that really need it, and has led to the creation of colossal bubbles that are bound to burst eventually. Those who remain bullish about share prices say fears of a crash are misplaced. The global economy is going to recover quickly as soon as mass vaccination programs get on top of the coronavirus pandemic. Yet even strong growth will not force central banks and finance ministers to withdraw the extraordinary amount of stimulus they have been providing because inflation will remain low. These two factors, a period of rapid catch-up and a benign policy stance, will boost corporate profits and so justify risking stock market valuations. But not everybody is convinced. The veteran British financier Jeremy Grantham, who co-founded the US investment firm GMO, fired off a warning to the company's clients recently. Jeremy Grantham did not pull his punches. He said, "The long, long bull market since 2009 has finally matured into a fully-fledged epic bubble," he added, featuring extreme overvaluation, explosive price increases, frenzied issuance, and historically speculative investor behavior, "I believe this event will be recorded as one of the greatest bubbles of financial history, right along with the South Sea bubble in 1929 and in 2000. For Jeremy Grantham, Tesla is the stock that proves the market has taken leave of its senses. The current market capitalization of $600 billion amounts to $1.25 million for each electric car sold, compared with $9,000 a car for General Motors. He asks, "What has 1929 got to equal that?" The assumption on Wall Street is that the US Federal Reserve will always stand behind the market. If prices fall precipitously, investors can sleep easy knowing that the chairman of the US Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell, and his colleagues will do what's necessary to limit losses and get the market rising again. Jeremy Grantham says this is wrong. He believes this bubble will burst in due time, no matter how hard the US Federal Reserve tries to support it, with consequent damaging effects on the economy and on portfolios. It's not all that hard to see the circumstances in which Jeremy Grantham could be proved right. There is a logical inconsistency in Wall Street's belief that it will do business as usual for the US once enough Americans have had their COVID jabs, and its conviction that monetary policy will remain as loose as it currently is. fresh dollops of stimulus might not actually be needed at a time when demand is going to be picking up anyway. Inflationary pressure is currently weak, but were that to change, the mood in the markets could also change quickly. The yield or interest rate on government bonds would start to rise and share prices would start to fall. Wall Street will be begging the US Federal Reserve to come to its rescue, but with inflation rising, it might feel uneasy about doing so. Will this happen? Who knows? But the financial markets are placing a lot of trust in the US Federal Reserve and the other central banks. It had better not be misplaced.
The debate.
Hello and a warm welcome to another edition of The Debate. I'm Behrouz Najafi. Israel once again has been accused of being an apartheid regime that enforces Jewish supremacy in the occupied Palestinian lands. Human rights groups say that Israel has created a system over all the territory in which Jews have full rights. Palestinians are divided into tiers with different levels of rights, but always below those of the Jews. Now, Tel Aviv has effective control over the Gaza Strip, which it has blockaded since 2006. In the West Bank, Palestinians live in disconnected enclaves under rigid military rule and devoid of political rights and security. They're also facing the dangers and risks of living under occupation. Stay for a debate on the issue.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has ordered the advancement of a plan to build over 800 more settler units in the occupied West Bank. Netanyahu's office says the units will be constructed in several settlement complexes. It, however, failed to determine a starting date for the project. The announcement comes in defiance of international law, which considers all Israeli settlements on occupied land as illegal. Even multiple United Nations Security Council resolutions have failed to deter Tel Aviv from its expansionist agenda. Many Palestinians say Netanyahu is using US President Donald Trump's remaining days in office to push ahead with his settlement ambitions.
Netanyahu and his regime are racing against time. They are using the time when U.S. President Donald Trump was in a presidency to approve more settlement projects and settlement units. And this is what happens today. Before the inauguration of the new American administration, Netanyahu has approved the building.
Palestinians have for decades expressed their anger and concern over the seizure of their lands and turning them into settler units. They have been demanding the international community to put a halt to Israel's settlement plans. In a latest push, Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammad Shtayyeh said the international community should oblige the Israeli occupying regime to stop its colonial projects in Palestine. The premier said the continued settlement activities show Israel's disregard for international laws and statutes. However, many see the Israeli settlement expansion in a much broader context. On Monday, an Israeli-based rights advocacy NGO accused Tel Aviv of being an apartheid regime that enforces Jewish supremacy on the occupied land. Betzalem said Israel has created a system in all occupied territories where Jewish people have full rights. The group that documents human rights violations in the Israeli-occupied territories says Palestinians in the West Bank live in disconnected enclaves under rigid military rule and without political rights.
You know, there's an international convention on the crime of apartheid and racial discrimination, which specifically says that people living in the same country should not be subjected to different sets of laws, and that's how it defines apartheid.
But what really gives the Israeli regime the courage to pursue the policy of oppression against Palestinians? Many say Washington's unconditional support for the Israeli regime is to blame. Donald Trump has been a staunch supporter of Netanyahu's settlement policy in the occupied territories. But given Israel's settlement expansions and its pursuance of the so-called Jewish supremacy agenda, the question arises whether the new U.S. administration will be any different to its predecessor in stopping Tel Aviv's apartheid policies, or will it turn a blind eye to them as it has been doing in the past 7 decades.
Let's get it started. Joining me will be human rights lawyer Daniel Kovalik from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and award-winning Palestinian journalist Dawood Katab from Amman. Welcome to the show, gentlemen. Let's go to Daniel. Drawing a comparison between apartheid in South Africa and Israel, observers argue that the Israeli apartheid in occupied Palestine is more militaristic and more brutal, while under South Africa, the blacks were never blockaded or killed, as Tel Aviv is doing in the case of the Palestinians. Do you agree?
I do, and so does, by the way, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who won the Nobel Prize. Of course, he's from South Africa. He's made that observation. In fact, I think even to call it apartheid is to understate the situation. I've been saying for a while that really this is a process of genocide. You know, look at what's happening with the coronavirus immunizations. Israel's giving it to Jews there, but not giving it to Palestinians. I mean, that's incredible. They're the occupying force. They have to make sure under international law, under international humanitarian law, that people get proper, you know, water, food, medical attention, which would include these immunizations. Israel's not only refusing to guarantee these things, they're preventing people in Palestine from getting these things, dumping sewage into farmland, into fresh water. This is an act of genocide.
Right. Now, turning to Amman, Dawood, how do you describe the lives of millions of Palestinians living under the ongoing Israeli occupation?
Well, it's clearly a different rule for Israel. I think the reason the apartheid is listed as a war crime. With the South African struggle against apartheid, the international community agreed to list apartheid as a war crime according to international humanitarian law. And so that's why you see a lot of usage of the term, and that's why you see the Israelis rejecting the term, because the moment that they accept the existence of apartheid, they basically concede that they are committing an ongoing war crime, because the settlements and the settlers are not supposed to be moved to occupied areas. The fact that you have settlers who are Israeli citizens who live under Israeli civilian law, living side by side with Palestinians who have no political rights and are under military law, you have a two-system situation. And so that's what apartheid is all about.
Mm-hmm. Daniel, apparently it's only Europe that's still denying the Israeli practice of this apartheid system in spite of overwhelming evidence of that effect. What's behind the Europeans' denial of this fact?
Well, because if they admitted it, they would be required to do something about it. You know, I mean, the irony, of course, is that Europe and the U.S., Canada always talk about the need to engage in humanitarian intervention in other countries to guarantee human rights and humanitarian law. If they admitted how bad the situation was for Palestine, they would have to act under their own arguments, you know? If any place in the world calls for some sort of humanitarian intervention, it would be in Palestine to protect them from Israel. And so, you know, you see the West downplaying how brutally the Palestinians are being treated for that reason.
Mm-hmm. Dawood, as Daniel mentioned, the Europeans need to do something about it if they admit the plight of Palestinians. And they are doing something about it. You know what they're doing? They're selling weapons to Israel. They're doing trade. They have commercial ties. They're even having, cultural, educational ties with the occupied regime that has no regard for international law and human rights. How could they justify this?
Well, you have to ask them, but they are trying to say, what you're trying to ask them, since they claim that they support two-state solution, that's their kind of natural kind of default statement. We support the two-state solution. Well, a two-state solution means Palestine and Israel. Israel exists and is a member of this land. If you do believe in a two-state solution, why don't you recognize the state of Palestine and then the state of Palestine as well? Will conduct negotiations with Israel on how to deal and how to manage the relationship between these two countries. But they refuse to do that. Only Sweden recognized the state of Palestine. And when you ask the rest of the countries, you know, your own parliament passed a resolution recognizing the state of Palestine. When will you, the executive branch, recognize the state of Palestine? They say, well, we want to do it as a whole. We want to kind of have a power behind the declaration, for when we recognize it, it will actually produce some results. And they've been saying that for the last 20 years. So they've not really tapped in on this idea of mass recognition, but at the same time, they're holding back in accepting what they're saying that they support, which is the two-state solution. Now, many Palestinians have stopped agreeing to the two-state solution, seeing what is happening, and that it must be more efficient for equal rights in a single state than to continue to go for the two-state solution. But the two-state solution has become a default, an easy statement that everybody can say. And even the Israelis say, we don't mind having something that Palestinians call a Palestinian state, but it will still have Israeli control on the borders, on the air, on the sea, on the water. But if you want to have a state, call it whatever you want. But what we want is a sovereign state that has control of its land and borders, and it's based on the 67 votes. That's what Palestinians want. And otherwise, Europe, as we said, is keeping up its own core standards.
Now, Daniel, as you know, the world is grappling with this deadly pandemic. Even in this situation, Tel Aviv does not abide by the international conventions that oblige the regime as an occupying power to come up and provide residents of those areas it has usurped with badly needed pharmaceuticals and medical care. Sky's the limit when it comes to impunity for Tel Aviv, isn't it?
Yes, of course. Again, Israel is now engaged in a robust immunization program for Israelis, and they are not administering immunizations to Palestinians. Again, the long-time embargo against Palestine and other actions that have been done to destroy Palestinian water supplies, these are all contributing to COVID, the COVID spread in Palestine. And again, it's by design. The Israelis want to destroy the Palestinian people. I'm convinced of that. And again, that's why I tend to call this a genocide, not just apartheid.
I see. Now, Daoud, let's look at it from a different aspect. How far has Trump's Allah support emboldened Netanyahu and other Israeli officials to further expand the illegal settlements? You know, as you see, during the last days of Trump at the White House, they're even accelerating this process.
Yeah, well, Trump has done a few things since taking office. He moved the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem in defiance of international law. Defunded the UN refugee agencies. He recognized the Golan Heights as Israeli territory, the annexation of the Golan Heights. And the worst part is that they declared a plan in which Israel is allowed to take one-third of the Palestinian territories, and in return they give Palestinians a few enclaves in the desert. And they're saying this is basically they wanted to dictate a plan on Palestinians in which they have to agree to give up one-third of their land in addition to their capital, East Jerusalem, and. So, and still Israel will control the borders in which they still call it a Palestinian state, but Israel will control all the borders. It was a sham of what's called the U.S. Trump vision of Palestinian policy. Joking, the deal of the century, but it basically has now failed as Trump in his elections. And I think Palestinians, like everybody else, are happy to see this man leave the political scene.
Mm-hmm. And Daniel, how do you look at this? I mean, the different administrations at the White House, they have always supported the Tel Aviv regime doing whatever they wanted to do against the Palestinians. But the support that President Trump gave to the Tel Aviv regime has been, many believe that has been all out par excellence. Do you agree?
Well, of course. I mean, the fact that the U.S. has now under Trump recognized Jerusalem as being, you know, the capital of Israel. This is a huge sea change. Again, the cutting off of the aid to the Palestinian refugees. This is a unique thing in U.S. history. This attempt by Trump, and successful attempt to get various countries in the region, including the Gulf states, to essentially turn their back on the Palestinian people, all these things are, you know, an incremental move towards Israel and, again, towards the ultimate abandonment of the Palestinians.
Daoud, let's take a glance at the so-called Washington brokered normalization deal signed by Tel Aviv recently in a number of Arab states. How big a role do those deals play in Israeli land grab policy and infringing on Palestinians' rights?
Well, let's dissect that. First of all, the four countries that have been involved in the normalization issue have had different levels of so-called normalization. The Sudanese have yet to approve the idea because their parliament had to meet and then they would approve it. The Moroccans have yet to also stipulate exactly what they plan to do, even though they've had some type of normal relations with Israel because of the Jewish Moroccans who live in Israel and who live in Morocco. So it has not been, of course, it was a stab against the Palestinians because the Arab countries committed that they would only normalize relationship with Israel once Israel withdrew from the occupied territories and agreed to a just solution of the refugee. So it weakened the Palestinian negotiating position. I don't think it has much to do. I mean, the Emirates have only like a million Emiratis, and Bahrain is like 800,000 people living in it. So they're two really tiny countries. I mean, they have a lot of money, but they're not really that big. So Sudan is a big country, and so is Morocco. So those would be much more important. And in a way, that's why they have not come to the pressure, even though each one of them had a deal with the Americans. The Sudanese wanted to be lifted from the terror list, and the Moroccans wanted somebody to recognize their sovereignty over the Western Sahara. Mm-hmm. So, in the end, it is a setback, but it's not a big setback because, on the bottom line, Palestinians live in the occupied territories. They're there. They're not going anywhere. And sooner or later, Israel has to figure out a way to deal. You marry us or divorce us. You either give Palestinians equal rights or you let Palestinians have their own state. You either share the power or you share the country. You cannot have it both ways. And what is happening now is apartheid. It's having it both ways. Israel wants to control the land and it doesn't want equal rights to the people. And that's why we're having this two-tier legal system. And what is interesting about Beit Salem's report today is that an Israeli major, mainstream Israeli human rights organization saying, we're no longer going to separate between Israel's activities in Israel and activities in occupied territories because it's a one country. Basically, it's one leadership that's deciding this this apartheid system, and it has to stop. And so I tip my hands to Beit Salem. It took them 50 years to come up with this decision, but it's good that they have come up with that. And I hope more and more Israelis understand what their government is doing.
Hopefully. Now, Daniel, Palestinians have been deprived of all their rights in the past several decades, as you know. Their lands and homes are stolen, and they're still being stolen and razed to the ground. They're denied an army to defend themselves. They're deprived of the free movement on their own land. The refugees are not allowed to go back home. They have no viable government. Some Arab states have betrayed them. So what choice and options do they have to see an end to this Israeli occupation and an end to their plight?
Well, I don't know, to be honest. I think they are running out of options, not because of anything they've done, but because of Israel and because the world community, again, has largely abandoned them, as you say. I think what has to happen is for people in the United States and in Europe to show solidarity with the Palestinian people, to demand that Palestine be recognized, to demand the Palestinians be given their right. That is the only thing that can be done to help Palestine, is that the people of the West have to stand up for the Palestinian people.
Daoud, what do you think? What choice do the Palestinians have?
Well, you know, I think they do have a number of things. I mean, some of it is self-inflicted wounds of differences and disunity. So we're hoping that there will be elections on May 22nd in the West Bank and Gaza, and we can start recreating our own national unity. That's the number one. We need to have a unified Palestinian position. Secondly, we need to really work with the Palestinian diaspora and with the people of solidarity, like Daniel and others, to really enact the BDS movement, the boycott, divestment, and sanctions. That has to really be the nonviolent tool that we have to use to force Israel to come to terms with the fact that it cannot live and control 5 million people against their will and deny the refugees the right to return. That has to change. And I think a boycott, divestment, and sanctions have to be used as a weapon, just like the South Africans used, to really get the world to put pressure on Israel to change its policy.
All right, on that note, we come to the end of this debate show. Let me thank our guests. We had human rights lawyer Daniel Kovalik out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and also award-winning Palestinian journalist Daoud Kattab, who joined us from Amman, Jordan, with their comments and contribution. I've been your host, Fehruz Najafi.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
A growing sea of bloggers, podcasters, message board moderators, conspiracy theorists, social media pundits, extremist preachers and news outlets feed off Trump directly, using the president's lies and latest tweets to garner likes, hits, donations, and ad revenue. To gain followers, they repost trending conspiracies loved by Trump fans on social media and attack racial justice activists whose calls for social change generate resentment on the right. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Mike Ludwig Ryder. This article is published under the heading, "The Trumps Have Fueled a Far-Right Media Monster That Is Not Going Away." Here's the details. On January 3rd, just 3 days before President Trump incited and cajoled the predominantly white mob that invaded Congress, Donald Trump Jr. retweeted a video of a scuffle between police and residents of Gatineau, Quebec, who were holding a private gathering in violation of local pandemic restrictions. Cops and residents blamed each other for the altercation, but regardless of the details, the president's oldest son and potential political heir warned, "This insanity is coming here if you don't wake the hell up." Trump Jr.'s tweet was then retweeted by Ashley Babbitt, the woman who was shot dead by police on Wednesday, January 6, after storming the Capitol building with violent extremists and angry Trump fans. "Nothing will stop us," Babbitt tweeted the day before her death, warning that the storm was descending on Washington, D.C. Babbitt is now a martyr on far-right message boards, very racist, obese, about avenging the death of a white woman. The video Trump Jr. retweeted was posted by a Canadian far-right journalist who recently asserted that Black Lives Matter is sponsored by Nike, CNN, and many mayors and local police departments. In reality, Black Lives Matter is the banner for a broad movement, as well as an umbrella for a range of organizations. It is not a single organization, let alone one with corporate sponsors. It is a movement directly in opposition to police departments, and of course, police in many U.S. cities violently cracked down on protests for racial justice last summer. However, on Trump Jr.'s Twitter feed, reality takes a backseat to red meat. A day before the assault on the Capitol, Trump Jr. urged Republicans voting in Georgia Senate runoffs to save America as you know it from the communists. That statement feeds false conspiracy narratives about congressional Democrats that drove Trump fans to violence. Narratives about a hostile takeover of the country are also a fundamental to the white nationalist thinking that has gained traction on the right on Trump, who tweeted, "We love you," to his supporters after his lies about the election convinced them to trash the Capitol. White supremacist hate groups often justify their violent ideologies under the guise of love. Love for their families, for their communities, for their nation, which are perceived to be under existential threat by encroaching others, said Margaret Huang, president of the Southern Poverty Law Center Action Fund, in a statement after the Capitol breach. The two Democrats who prevailed in Georgia runoffs and others in the Senate are not authoritarian communists, of course, but this and other false narratives can be found supplanting facts across the right-wing media universe. A growing sea of bloggers, podcasters, message board moderators, conspiracy theorists, social media pundits, extremist preachers, and news outlets feed off Trump directly, using the president's lies, and until this week,
latest tweets to garner likes, hits, donations, and ad revenue. To gain followers, they repost trending conspiracies loved by Trump fans on social media and attack racial justice activists whose calls for social change generate resentment on the right. The relationship is symbiotic. Trump constantly paints the mainstream and left-leaning media as illegitimate, boosting demand for conspirational right-wing alternatives that recycle Trump's lies into content and affirm his followers' beliefs. The Trump family and its right-wing celebrity allies then use the far-right to bypass the rest of the media and feed conspiracy theories to millions of people. None of this is new. Trump has attacked the media for years, and the disinformation he spread about the COVID-19 pandemic provided a preview of the contested election. With the president's election challenges thrown out of course, and more recently, some Republican leaders turning against his effort, far-right media became Trump's sharpest tool for undermining the election he lost. A poll in late December found that 68% of Republicans believe the November election was not free and fair, and 36% say Trump should not concede, no matter what, even if he is unable to present evidence of widespread voter fraud. It doesn't matter that the supposed evidence did not hold up in the court. More than half of Republicans said the courts are biased against Trump, even though the president appointed some of the judges who threw out his campaign's lawsuits. The Trumps, along with right-wing pundits and conspiracy hucksters, have convinced a large share of the electorate that anything defying their narratives is a lie told by Democrats, the media, or the deep state. Those who follow the right-wing media saw plenty of warning signs ahead of the violence in Washington, D.C. Between January 1st and January 4th, posts with calls for violence were found on Parler, Twitter, TikTok, and the pro-Trump message board, The Donner, according to analysis by Right-Wing Watch. Posts calling for violence, including the arrest and execution of politicians, on The Donut alone received 40,000 engagements. Some of the calls for violence are linked to the QAnon conspiracy theory, which holds that Democrats are an elite, cabal, satanic pedophiles, among other bizarre beliefs. On January 6th, an armed ultra-nationalist with zip-tie handcuffs was photographed storming congressional chambers. In the days before the violence at Capitol, organizers of the Stop the Steal rally took to social media and various far-right outlets to argue that Democrats had stolen the election. They also increasingly mentioned civil war while attacking anti-fascist and Black Lives Matter activists, according to Right-Wing Watch. Pro-Trump attorney Lynn Wood was simultaneously spreading QAnon lies about child rapists and calling for Vice President Mike Pence to be arrested and executed for his disloyalty to Trump. The memes of nooses made the rounds, and a hangman's gallows was erected outside the Capitol during the mob attack. Wood also represents Kylie Rittenhouse, who became a right-wing hero after shooting three people at a Black Lives Matter protest in Kenosha, Wisconsin. With Trump unwilling to concede the election and coddling his supporters who attacked Congress, Facebook suspended the president's account for an indefinite period of time. On Friday afternoon, Twitter finally kicked Trump off for good. As of this writing, Wood's Twitter account is suspended as well. Their post crossed a clear line with a speech that led to harm. However, Trump is not the only one in his orbit whose public statements foment hate and violence. Should Trump Jr.'s account be suspended? What about Rudy Giuliani, who used Twitter to peddle false conspiracy theories about a stolen election before urging Stop the Steal protesters to hold a trial by combat at the Capitol? While both Trump Jr. and Giuliani asked the Trump loyalists to remain peaceful after the violence erupted, it was the widespread belief among Trump supporters that the election, if not their perceived white Christian way of life, is being stolen from them that sparked the violence. When Facebook removed hundreds of QAnon groups and accounts for right-wing militias that glorify violence, the company also shut down left-wing pages, potentially to dodge accusations of ideological prejudice. While the anarchists and anti-fascists who lost their pages have a radical perspective, they were not spreading hate or disinformation, and they argued that Facebook had effectively equated anti-fascist and anti-racist organizing with dangerous conspiracies and white nationalist militias. As the anarchist at Crime Ethnic wrote, suppressing the voices of those who seek to protect their communities from institutional and white supremacist violence is an intentional decision to normalize violence as long as the ones employing it hold institutional power. The right-wing media universe that helped Trump foment the violence we witnessed recently will not disappear when the president leaves the White House. In fact, Trump, his family, and his remaining allies will likely rely on far-right media to stay relevant until the next campaign season. New ultra-right stars will likely be born online and ride Trump's catalyst, as did the two QAnon proponents who were recently elected to Congress. The Proud Boys and white nationalist groups will likely continue using conspiracies and far-right media as recruiting tools, and anti-fascists will continue confronting them online and in the streets. However, after the attack on Capitol and the suspension of Trump's social media accounts, the far-right media may become increasingly isolated, as Democrats and even some Republican leaders call for Trump's early removal from office. However, even within its own bubble, the force and power of far-right media must not be underestimated. After all, it plays a seismic role in paving the way for Trump's presidency.